The cumulative stress and sleep deprivation were exacting a toll I never could have imagined. It was a small moment, a few minutes after we began hiking on day 38, that crystallized how defeated I was. I didn't break down crying. I didn't fall asleep standing up. It was something simple and pathetic. A route, one of a trillion I'd seen and avoided over the past several weeks. But as I saw it coming, I didn't know what to do. Was I supposed to step around it or over it? I just couldn't remember. When it finally came, I tripped on it and stumbled forward. I'd forgotten how to raise my legs, how to run like a sane person. In Vermont, I'd thought I'd hit rock bottom, but the granite load of the White Mountains of New Hampshire pushed me even farther down. And then I broke. Just like everybody had warned. Suddenly, running down toward us, almost floating, was a guy in a sleek running kit, breathing easily and lightly. He moved like a memory of myself, like Elvinado had once upon a time. "Hey, Scott," he said. I didn't know him. "How are you doing, man?" I slowly tilted my head upward and then mumbled, "How the fuck do you think I'm doing?" Within a few steps, I was mortified that I had said that out loud. My sensors were on break, having a smoke out back with that genie who had escaped from the bottle. It wasn't like me to snap at someone out on the trail, especially someone who had simply asked how I was doing. I realized almost immediately that my short fuse had to be a symptom of something deeper. I entertained the idea of turning around, chasing the runner down, and apologizing right then and there. But that just made things worse. It was hard for me to even imagine myself going fast enough to catch up to him. The truth was, I was crawling. It felt like I was on all fours, moving forward inch by inch. Of course, I had known that I would go through stretches like this, but I had also known deep down in my bones and muscles, that by this point on the journey, I would have become trail-hardened, like I always had before. By now, I should be stronger. That transformation wasn't happening. I wasn't becoming a sharper version of myself. I was getting smaller, slower, and weaker. I consoled myself with the thought that my current state, equal parts escaped convict and mobile shipwreck, was not the worst state I could be in. I could be sitting still, either passed out or asleep, back on that rock, in that motel, in Castle Black, or on my own couch, dreaming about throwing away the record. As long as I was falling forward and getting up to fall again, I wouldn't come in last in the race against myself. I'd had some education in this kind of overreach before, way back in 2000, back when I was really at my physical peak. I won the Western States 100. It was the second year in a row I'd won it. That would have been enough for almost anyone. But I got into the Hard Rock 100 that year too, and decided I'd do that race right after Western. I'd have only 2 weeks off, 2 weeks to recover. There was no way I could win it, and I knew I'd be tired. But I figured I could at least cruise the race and enjoy it. Maybe get the lay of the land for the next attempt. The real attempt. I dropped out of the Hard Rock after 42 miles. My legs were destroyed. I had been young and naive and way too optimistic about how well I'd recover. The truth was, and is, that mountains humble you. They humbled me. You can steal a performance or two, but you'd better be prepared to sit back and rest after your finish. A decade and a half later, I was older and less naive. I hadn't thought I'd be blazing through this section of the White Mountains, but I'd thought I'd at least be upright. By the middle of day 38, I was preserving what little energy I had left by avoiding decision-making altogether. I just pressed play and let Timmy and Special Forces tell me when to stop. There was one delectable moment that day in the Whites. We came to a little cabin called Zeeland Falls Hut, an oasis for hikers. I was so spent, it felt like I was taking a line of credit, that I could never pay back, and I slumped on a bench outside. I didn't want to be lured inside, lest I lay my head down to sleep. But even outside, there was peace. I could hear hikers and the young staff cooking and laughing. And it was where Timmy found a priceless treasure. Later I learned that Timmy had left $20 for a massive bag of potato chips. An absurd amount in the real world. But in the wilderness, it was worth it. I would have paid $100. The fat, the saltiness, the crunchy carbs, they were pure comfort. All three of us were shoveling them in with abandon. Timmy later showed me a picture he took of me with my little feast. I was guarding a pile of chips in my lap and looked pitiful. First I laughed, and then I realized I barely recognized myself. "You look like a fugitive emerging from a year in hiding," he joked. Timmy always knew how to employ the best gallows humor. 9 potato chip fueled miles later, at 3 p.m., we stumbled into a clearing and a jam-packed trailhead parking lot. We had finally arrived at Crawford Notch, and I still had a disturbing 24 miles to go that day, including a 5,000-foot climb up to the summit of Mount Washington. The crowd waiting at Crawford Notch included Jaylu, who'd expected me to arrive there at 9 a.m. She had been sending runners up the trail to try and find me all morning, a wise tactic, since it also allowed her to have some peace and quiet there at the trailhead. Once I got there, she immediately tried to get me rested and ready. Maybe if I'd had Jenny back in 2000, she'd have talked me out of trying that audacious double dip of the Western States and Hard Rock that had humbled me. Now, luckily, I had people who told me what I needed to hear. Timmy, for one. It was Timmy who had seen me snap at that innocent runner we'd crossed. Like Jaylu, he realized I needed protection. From myself, mostly. So he leaped into action before I could reveal the antisocial depths to which I'd fallen. He became the jester of the whites, cracking jokes and generally keeping people's attention off me, while special forces guided me down the path. The key thing he did was create a buffer of approximately 50 feet of trail space between me and the people behind. If a group started running faster, or if I slowed down, he would hold the gang back until the 50-foot cushion was restored. Under other circumstances, I would have felt bad about keeping myself so separate. I wanted to be a part of the jovial group of runners, but I wasn't in the right state of mind. It was the greatest gift anyone could have given me at the time, the gift of not having to be on. Still, Timmy couldn't hide everything from the others. He later told me that at one point, at the head of a bunch of eager runners, I stopped so I could pee. I didn't even move off the trail. I just stopped, relieved myself right there, and then kept running. He said I was like a feral animal, unbothered by courtesies. At Crawford Notch, Castle Black was practically in a ditch. It had been the only open parking space, but it didn't matter. When I got there, all I wanted to do was lie down and get some solid sleep. Looking back, I realized I should have spent the night at Crawford Notch, or even better, at Franconia Notch, and ditched the Galehead goal. I probably should have killed the rest of day 38, called it good once I'd gotten 14 miles from Galehead. I needed sleep. But Jaylu and I could hear Horty saying, "Stay on schedule." I wasn't thinking for myself. I was in hurry-up offense mode. I didn't have time to recoup, so I passed out for just a few hours. Timmy quickly joined a group of young, yet seasoned thru-hikers, and their parking lot party and sparked a fun Q&A on the ways of the trail. After a handful of beers and a sleepless 36 hours, he was buzzing like a drunken gnat. But he quickly sobered when it was go time, and he went from being jester to king soldier and started rounding up the troops. Special forces helped too. He enlisted another stout local runner, Tristan, to hike into the night with us. Tristan was new to me, but I could tell he was wicked strong, and I was more than satisfied with the way our team was shaping up. That was the one positive I pocketed as we made our way out of Crawford Notch at dusk and set out for the next goal, the Lake of the Clouds hut, the only hut in the White Mountains above treeline, and one of the most stunning spots on the whole trail. Around midnight, we had to make an unscheduled stop at another hut because it was dangerous to keep moving on granite slabs and rock piles when it was dark and I was so sleep-deprived. There was a scary moment when we were told there was simply no more room for us at the hut. But Tristan came through for us. He'd worked out here and was able to call in a favor, a small favor. We crashed on the kitchen floor. It was quiet and warm in the kitchen, and just watching Special Forces inflate a sleeping pad made me groggy. I fell asleep instantly and got 4 or 5 solid hours, which felt like an illicit luxury. I did some math while I drifted to sleep, and the reality of how many miles I'd covered in the white sank in. And it wasn't good. I'd moved so slowly. I realized I'd lost an entire day on the record in a matter of 36 hours. My one-day cushion was gone. There was no room for anything but perfection now. The next morning was glorious, with blue skies and a fiery sun blazing behind the white tip of Mount Washington. It towered over us, rising 6,288 feet, making it the highest peak in the Whites and one of the highest on the trail. We started before sunrise and climbed a ridge as the sky behind the summit brightened to yellow. The sun's rays were invigorating, and the alpine terrain loosened my muscles and lightened my mood. We steadily climbed a couple of thousand feet in the next 4 miles, and then the trail plateaued into a nice rolling stretch, finally giving me an opportunity to open up and run after days of fighting boulders, slabs, and roots. For the first time prior to the pits of her mud, I felt a bit of ease. Still, we couldn't count on the warm, clear weather lasting. Mount Washington is absolutely infamous for its unpredictable, overwhelming outbreaks of horrific weather, including blinding whiteouts that can occur at almost any time of the year. The average wind on Mount Washington is 35 miles per hour, and there's a sign at the weather station on top that says, "The highest wind ever observed by man was recorded here. 231 miles per hour. It can snow any month of the year, averaging 42 feet annually, and there have been 137 fatalities on the mountain, mostly due to the constant collisions of powerful weather patterns. The mountain is widely known as the most dangerous small mountain in the world. In 2006, a 23-year-old hiker walked to the summit on a warm day. Suddenly, he was hit by a storm so severe that by the time he was rescued, he'd suffered massive brain damage. In 2013, an experienced hiker on the trail became so disoriented by the weather that she wandered into the cold and eventually died a short distance from the Lake of the Clouds hut. It wasn't the hut's first tragedy. There was a solemn air to the place, reminding you that Mother Nature was a humbling force. A pair of boots hung from a nail in the hut. Legend had it that they had to be stopped from walking by themselves after the hiker wearing them died. There were so many ghosts in this immediate area that they weren't even named individually. They were known collectively as the Presence. Jaylu met me at the summit of Mount Washington, and together we took it all in. We were on the roof of the long tunnel. It was a profound, peaceful reminder that we were out there together, and we'd come so far. It was the 4th of July, and with Jenny in our group, we rock-hopped and jostled along the boulders on the tops of Mounts Washington, Jefferson, and Madison, to the bottom of Pinkham Notch, following the infamous Presidential Traverse. Even in my beaten-down state, I was able to enjoy this alpine path with Jaylu and our new friends. We hadn't been above the tree line together the entire trip, and this was welcome variety, more familiar to us than running in the low and woody peaks 1,800 miles south. We finally ran out of the Whites, and we paused for a moment before plunging into the next range, the Wildcats. I had a fresh team of Uber runners. I had Jaylu, I had Timmy. I also had my body, although I didn't know how much of it still functioned. I think I had hope. And I had a firm belief that I needed a lot more than hope. On day 39, we pushed until 2 in the morning to stay on our razor-thin timeline. I was stumbling in the dark, but there was no place flat enough to lie down, even if my team would allow me to. In all directions, I saw rocks and boulders and roots carpeting the forest floor. We were out of the presidential range, but the lesser-known wildcats were just as formidable. The night seemed to stretch into eternity, but we finally made it to the only suitable place to sleep, the appropriately named Imp Shelter. As it seemed that a mischievous sprite or two was playing an exhausting, drawn-out, and disagreeable prank on me. Nocturnal rodents gnawed at our hanging packs and scurried over my nylon sleeping bag. I was frequently jolted awake by microbursts of nightmarish anxiety as I fretted about falling behind, falling down, and failing myself and Jaylu. I'd just as quickly cross back into the land of Nod, and the visions of running late. I kept thinking Special Forces was trying to get me up, and then I'd realize it was mice, or rats, or worse. I got 3 hours of sleep if you added all the pieces together. I kept trying to convince myself it was all a bad dream.
When Jerker emerged from the woods near Gorham, New Hampshire, in the dawn of day 40, I realized I hadn't seen him any of the last 3 nights. They had taken their toll. He was unrecognizable. His face had aged 20 years, and he had a horrible patchy beard. His limbs looked extra long and sinewy, and his fingernails were black with dirt. He didn't even smell like himself. He smelled like our compost bin back home. Timmy pointed out that he wasn't becoming one with the trail. He was becoming the trail. He speculated that if we sprinkled some seeds on Jerker, they would sprout. It wasn't just physical. He had been drifting further and further away from the person I knew. He had a lifeless blank stare, like his mind wasn't all there. He reminded me of a soldier who'd gone off to war and came back the same, but different. His fine motor skills were shot, and the tremors in both his hands had become almost constant. He'd also picked up an odd tick I'd never seen before, letting his lips flap as he exhaled like a tired horse. He tripped on everything, the tiniest roots and rocks. I could swear he was even tripping on pine needles. Every misstep would pinch his sciatic nerve, and he would jolt upright and grab his lower back. Finally, one pesky blister on the top of his toe was infected, making him wince every time he stubbed it. He asked me to grab his big shoes, the size 12 pair, that would accommodate the blister. I dug around in the shoe bin in Castle Black, but couldn't find them. I asked Jerker if he knew where they went. He scrunched up his face and let out a long exhale. Damn, I gave those to No Poles back in Tennessee when I thought I was done. Oh well, such is trail magic. He looked too tired to care, too empty for regrets. Before Jerker could sit down, Timmy whisked him away and walked him down the road to a nearby hiker hostel. The owner was kind, and she let Scott take a hot shower while she made him a smoothie and toast with peanut butter. The hospitality was verifiably magical because, after 3 sleep-deprived nights, that morning of July 5th, Jerker emerged from the hostel with new energy. He was clean, fed, and ready to go. It was also a moment of major changeover for our whole team. Special Forces and Gabe had to head home, so we assembled replacement runners, some old faces and some new, to help Scott get into the Mahoosic Range, the last part of the White Mountains and one that pushed all the way into Maine. One of the stray runners who joined our caravan was a personal favorite. He had actually crossed our paths earlier, on day 36, when he had left a vegan chocolate cake on the summit of Mount Cube for Scott. He reappeared in New Hampshire on day 37 and got into the habit of placing organic cherries all around Castle Black, like blessings. He also wore very, very, very short shorts. We called him the Cherry Shaman. When he joined us outside the hostel on day 40, He told us he was supposed to run a race that morning, but had felt called to be here instead. That was his word, called. He said he was part of the team now, and then he handed us a lengthy typed poem with strict instructions. This must be read to Scott in iambic pentameter, at a heart rate of 44 to 48 beats per second, on every other footfall. The last stanza read, "Perfectly normal, perfectly balanced, and perfectly equalized will be the condition when the being leaves the van each day. Namaste." Nama go running. When Jerker left the van that morning, I don't know if he was balanced and equalized, and he certainly wasn't normal, but I think the Cherry Shaman's mantra did enlighten him, because he seemed to have regained a steady running pace.
Maine, 282 miles. All of us have had the experience of a sudden joy that came when nothing in the world had forewarned us of its coming. A joy so thrilling that if it was born of misery, we remembered even the misery with tenderness. Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, Wind, Sand, and Stars. Chapter 14, Dancing with the Genie. Day 40. The morning's descent into Gorham mirrored the overall decline in my bandwidth, as both were gradual, rocky, and absolute. And by the time we had reached Jailu and Castle Black, my mental capacity was fried, and I was no longer transmitting any signal. It was as if I had placed my brain on airplane mode. We can all relate to those annoying conversations caused by a wavering cell signal, where you catch only every other word. Like those frustrating phone calls, I was unable to make myself understood, as if I was actually speaking and listening in fragments. It felt like my mind was coming in and out of reception. When I had zero bars, I would become withdrawn and incommunicado, equal parts off the grid and off my rocker. But then I'd round a turn, get to the top of a rise, and suddenly I'd be full bars. It was during these times when I joyously crested the surface that I'd reach out to connect, as I typically love to converse and prompt discussions. And just like when your multiple inboxes noisily ping with each new notice, I would chime in to the conversations, catching the punchlines, sometimes even finishing them, signaling to my trailmates that I was back in service. My new running partners were two of the greatest runners you've never heard of, Ryan and Christina Welts, locals who knew Hordy. It was a joy to watch them navigate the trail. They were like kids on a jungle gym, skating down slabs, hopping over gaps, swinging off branches and roots they dubbed cedar handrails. Ryan held the FKT for the section of AT called the Mahoosic Traverse, so this part of the state was his training ground. They were more than just happy. They were also well prepared. Along with their buddy Nate, they carried large backpacks full of lightweight camping gear and wonderfully non-essential comforts such as a giant Rice Krispies treat the size of a pillow. They were into gutting it out and laughing while they did it. They were a welcome change of pace from the heaviness and grandeur of the whites and from all my depressingly slow miles there. I let myself forget about the miles and time altogether, and the feeling that the record had almost certainly slipped away from me. I was fully present. I was moving well, but I didn't think too much about it. It was way too soon to start feeling confident again. As we approached the main border, my final crossing, the excitement among the members of our group started to build. Timmy and Jailu hiked in to meet us right before the border. There was no way she was going to miss crossing that line together. They brought sleeping bags so that they could stay at the shelter with us. Right where the trail crossed the border, we saw a sign that read Springer Mountain, 1,899.8 miles. Katahdin, 281.4 miles. It was monumental, the 14th and final state. It had never grown old and tired. It hit me deep to my core. A creamsicle sunset made the moment especially magical, and ranked with the most memorable of times I'd cultivated on the trail since signing my name in the guestbook and starting off into the Georgian darkness. If I don't make it, or if I don't make the record, this will still be worth it. I kept that thought to myself. But those few hours made that clear to me. To be out here with Jaylu and Timmy, doing what we all loved, was enough. The trail across the higher Mahusik ridgeline wove through the trees, and it was beautiful. When the trail wasn't rocky, we were walking on wooden planks to cross over bogs of mud and silt, moose territory. The views over the big north country were full of untamed splendor. Pretty soon, the terrain got so steep, we had to hold on to metal handrails drilled into the granite, what Timmy called stone staples. Before it got totally dark, we made it to Full Goose Shelter, and we were exuberant, just coursing with adrenaline. 30 minutes later, we fell asleep like logs to the chainsaw snores of tired souls who were already tucked into the shelter. We set off in the pre-dawn darkness, with Timmy and Jaylu taking a side trail to peel off the AT, while I dove deeper into the Mahusik's bowels, a deep gully that looked like a glacier had dumped all of its contents into a jumbled mess at the bottom. Massive boulders, crushed rock beds, and downed trees with gigantic root balls were littered everywhere. AT through hikers know it as the hardest mile, and can take over 2 hours to pass through the mangled mess. I squeezed my body through fissures and miniature slot canyons formed by stacks of angular blocks. On all fours, I scrambled over the top of moss-covered rocks, grabbing onto roots and branches of hemlocks and balsam firs. The genie that had escaped the bottle near Galehead Hut was back, and I couldn't stuff him back in, so I had to wrestle with him, under, over, and through this mile for 1 hour and 20 minutes, before I danced through the Mahusik Notch with 2 left feet. 7 miles later, I hit Grafton Notch as the midday sun was baking the pavement parking lot. While reloading my pack at Castle Black, I heard a fellow Nobo thru-hiker shout out, "Hey, Scott, you're catching up to the badasses. It's time to start acting like one." Even though I was starting to approach the strongest hikers of the AT class of 2015, I sure didn't feel like I was much of a badass. We looked at the numbers. On day 39, I'd done only 32 miles. Day 40 had been worse, 29 miles. Day 41 was only 30. I became painfully aware of the meager progress I'd been making. I'd been pushing myself to the limit, but the mileage wasn't reflecting that. That thru-hiker made me reflect back to 2006, when Caballo Blanco tried getting under my skin in hopes of motivating me to venture down to race the Tarahumaran. In an email, he asked, "How Shingon are you?" And for this venture, if I wanted the record, I would need to be a lot more badass. Day 42 did not start auspiciously. I'd ended day 41 by sleeping more hours than I should have, so Jaylu was already upset at me when dawn arrived, and I woke up dragging my feet, knowing I'd have to cover extra miles. Actually, I woke up to the sound of moose hooves galloping across pavement. Everyone else woke up too and scrambled to avoid getting trampled by the fatally powerful legs of the massive beast. As I dawdled in the van, doing my best to delay the start of another grueling day, Timmy joked to Jaylu that I left 2 ruts in the trail from my dragging feet. Back in Boulder, I'd figured I'd be done with the whole trail by now. Instead, I felt like I was in a hamster wheel. I was running, but my progress was a myth. Main miles just seemed to keep going nowhere. Especially disheartening was how meandering the trail got up here, meaning that I'd sometimes be running due south in order to go north. 8 miles into the day, I slipped on a slab of rock and landed on my hip. In the process, I snapped my hiking pole in half. The two parts were just barely connected by some carbon fibers. It was useless. I was so angry at the rock, I thrashed the remains of the pole against it, over and over, until it finally shattered completely. Luis had returned for one more AT tour of duty, and he stepped back. His face said everything. I was unrecognizable. Maybe I'd finally snapped altogether. Still, everyone on the team and everyone who came out to see me kept saying encouraging things like, "You're almost there," and "Only 4 more days left," like it was the surest thing in the world. Perversely, their excitement for me made me feel worse. I was bending in half, hanging on by only a few threads, like my hiking pole. It was on day 42 that I morosely asked the local runners to run on ahead. They did, no questions asked. I needed space alone to face the numbers. There was an overwhelming sadness that I needed to process all by myself. I had to remind myself that the whole trip wasn't a waste, that the experience was greater than the record. I wanted to feel the emotions that came with accepting it was over. It would have been easier to bottle them up, but they were too heavy. This was what I came for, but it was still hard to stomach. I was dead in the water, floating face down. FKT'd. I walked forward and carried that burden with me. It was going to take more miles and more mud to process. Sure enough, almost on cue, I sank deep into some hidden mud. That was the whole Appalachian Trail in a nutshell. Just when you think you have the rhythm, it cuts you off at the knees. Later that day, Timmy would be leaving, and a strong midsummer storm was headed our way. The hits kept coming, so I'd be running into wet, cold chaos with a group made up of eager and fully capable runners, but no one I had a deep connection with. The tempest would coincide with our push up Saddleback Mountain, which would inevitably stretch into the wee hours of the morning. With Timmy leaving, it'd be like changing ship captains mid-hurricane. It was too much. I called Jenny and Timmy over to the edge of the van, where I sat slouched in defeat, and told them straight up, "I've done the math. The math doesn't work. I'm sorry. I fucked up. It's over." There weren't enough hours in the day to break the record. I told them it was fine. I told them I wasn't quitting, that I'd get to Katahdin, but I'd just walk it in. There was no point to continuing with the sleepless nights of zombie marching. They didn't listen. Jaylu folded an entire pizza into one Ziploc bag and filled another with a smorgasbord of cliff shots and cliff bars and other staples. She packed my stuff for me like I was a kid going off to summer camp. Timmy peered into my eyes and looked straight into my soul, deeper than even old Horty had, and said, "You're so close. I've seen you go to the edge and back the last 10 days. You've got this, Scotty." I didn't believe him. All that full bar connectivity I'd had in the Mahoosics had disappeared entirely. I was out of service once again. Over the past 42 days, I'd seesawed back and forth between really believing I could set the FKT and coming to terms with the fact that I wouldn't, but this time didn't feel like part of that cycle. This was permanent. This was it. The math was the math. I was switching gears. I was starting to look forward to a leisurely hike through the rest of the Maine woods. I looked at Timmy with clarity. "It's not humanly possible. The nail is in the coffin."
I was in shock. What the hell was my crazy, blurry-eyed, scrawny-ass, shaky-handed husband talking about? It's over? And now we were gonna walk it in? Just like Leadville 2013 all over again? Oh, hell no. I hadn't worked this hard and gotten this far to suddenly give up and cruise lazily through Maine on day 42. He didn't want to hurt anymore, and I didn't want him to either, but he'd have to wait until he got to the other end of this sufferfest for that relief. We were too close to quit. But I did the math. There's not enough hours in the days. I fucked up. "What are you talking about? We have 5 days. You can do it." Visibly frustrated, he sighed. "Jaylu, today is day 42. The record is 46 days, so that's only 4 days. Jerker, hello? We get the entire 46th day plus another 11 hours on day 47. He stared at me and I saw his mind sputter. I rolled my eyes. Was he kidding me? All this drama because he'd been spewing drunk math? They say not to drive or operate heavy machinery while drowsy. I think they should add arithmetic to that list. We packed a shit ton of food and sent him on his way with two strangers. I said goodbye to Timmy. Like Speedgoat, he really didn't want to leave our team, but he had work obligations back home. His imminent departure made me realize I had gotten dependent on him to help me strategize and keep morale up. Both those things had become harder in the past couple of days as we started to enter really wild territory. Thankfully, Timmy had been marshaling replacement. It turned out that our friends, Topher and Kim, had understood how badly we needed them after all. It was great timing because Topher had recently quit his job and was hanging in Mammoth Lakes with a bunch of elite ultrarunners when he received Jerker's SOS message. Jerker had sounded so dire, Toph later told me, that he'd replayed the message on speakerphone, and everyone winced from the palpable sounds of desperation. They immediately booked tickets to Portland, Maine, and they would be arriving that night. Best of all, the two of them with Timmy had been devising a game plan for what would be the most critical part of our trip and the biggest logistical puzzle. The 100-mile wilderness. The infamous stretch of central Maine that humbles thru-hikers every season. Along with Toph and Kim, one other person was set to arrive. A total ultra-running powerhouse who was as invaluable to Jerker as she was to me. I was so relieved to see Chrissy. She looked much better than me. Rested, clean, bright-eyed, and tanned. She was one of my best friends, and it felt like she'd brought a piece of home with her. I thought Chrissy would want all the details on Scott right away, but she was more concerned about how I was doing. After 42 days and nights of serving Jerker, I was unashamedly eager for some time for myself. Chrissy Mayle and I had met way back in 2001 when we were both new hires at a footwear company in Seattle and shared a cubicle. I'd never been a runner before, and she was just transitioning from running track to going longer distances. It blew my mind back then. The thought of running a marathon and beyond sounded outlandish to me. But here Chrissy was, a sweet, normal, even-keeled girl about to run her first 50K race. Her enthusiasm was infectious. In 2 years, I went from not running at all to running a half marathon, a full marathon, and then my first 50K. I wasn't fast like her, but I could understand why she loved it. Over the years since, we'd traveled around the world together, going to races from Hong Kong to France, and I crewed for her at some big ones like Western States and Wasatch. She'd known Jerker even longer than me. He was the one who got her into trail running when they worked at the Seattle Running Company. They were like brother and sister. So it was no surprise that she was a little grossed out in 2008 when I told her he and I had hooked up. She had caught a ride out to the trail from a Mainer, and she managed to intersect with me near Rangeley Lake, a beautiful spot just west of Saddleback Mountain. Almost as soon as she got there, I asked, naturally, "You want to jump in the lake?" A storm was brewing, but it was still warm enough to swim. We changed in the van and caught the last rays of sunlight. "Whoa, look at all your bug bites!" She pointed to my arms and legs. I hardly noticed them anymore. They were reminders of the Deep South, which felt like a lifetime ago. I wondered what else had changed about me. After drying off, we hopped in Castle Black and drove to Sugarloaf Mountain. On the way, I brought her up to speed on Scott's status and prospects. By the time we got to the mountain, it was really pouring, and we booked a room at the ski resort. Our room was total luxury, and I've got no regrets. I appreciated every bit of it, starting with the hot water and ending with the clean sheets and down comforter. There was even an outdoor hot tub, and that night we got in it and gazed up at Saddleback Mountain. It was raining hard and the mountain was smothered in cold fog, and I wondered if Jerker had made it to his destination that night, a rustic three-sided lean-to. It was so nice to feel comfortable and clean, but I did feel a twinge of guilt in not even knowing where Scott was at that moment. My imagination began to run wild. Maybe he was out there in the storm, hunkered down in his greasy fart sack with two near strangers while I was having a blast with my best friend. Even in a queen-size bed with tons of pillows, I couldn't sleep more than 6 hours. I jumped out of bed as soon as I woke up and checked the tracker. Jerker was already on the move, which was good, but it crossed my mind that maybe he hadn't actually stopped that night. I hoped that wasn't the case. It'd really make me feel guilty about the hotel. Topher and Kim met us that morning, day 43, at the hotel, and we hashed out a plan. They came prepared with a map collection that would have made Speed Goat proud. Toph had downloaded a few AT apps on his phone, including one that gave him real-time GPS locations, so he could calculate Jerker's pace when they were running together. The plan that morning focused on the few but serious remaining obstacles. The Kennebec River was 36 miles up the trail. If he was moving well, he would reach the river in the middle of the night. "Do not ford," the guidebook warned. "Take ferry service." I looked up the ferry service, which turned out to be a man in a canoe, and found that the hours of operation were from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. We estimated Jerker could reach the river's edge just after midnight, so that wasn't going to work for us. Everyone following our progress closely figured the same thing and debated online about what Scott was going to do. Someone with the ferry service said if Jerker didn't use the official ferry, his record wouldn't be official. Other people quickly pointed out that previous AT-FKT record holders, including Horty, didn't pay the $50 to use the ferry. Horty forded the river. That was an option, but one I wasn't too psyched about. We had never been to this river before and had no idea about the currents or what lay downstream. I didn't trust Jerker in his sleep-deprived state to walk across in the dark. He was starting to resemble a piece of driftwood, and I pictured him floating away. So when Mandy and John, the owners of a local adventure center nearby, volunteered to stash canoes for us to use when we arrived, we thanked our lucky stars, and a local runner, Gary, for that fortuitous piece of priceless trail magic. The second hurdle was the 100-mile wilderness. I was impressed at how much research Toph and Kim had already done. It's a uniquely complicated section of the trail to support because it is crisscrossed by logging roads, and the entrances to the wilderness are guarded by locked gates that open and close at specific times. So once we got in, we wouldn't be able to leave until the gates reopened. If we took too long and got caught inside, we could be screwed. There were also no amenities of any kind once inside. We studied the maps and entered the wilderness as soon as possible. Once we were inside, Topher suggested we drive our routes and scout out our meeting locations just to make sure our vehicles could get to each destination. That stereotypical phrase, said with a northern Maine accent, "You can't get there from here," was invented for places like this. Jerker would cross the 2,000-mile mark this morning. Only 189 miles lay between him and Katahdin. We were about to find out if we could get there from here.
Chapter 15. The 100-Mile Nightmare. Day 42. I probably shouldn't have been crunching numbers in the state I was in. When Jalu corrected me and pointed out that I had an entire day that I'd overlooked, it was undeniably bittersweet. The FKT was still possible. But, man, did that leisurely walk to Katahdin sound good? Not yet, though. Day 42 hinged on that moment. Before it, before Jalu had brought me to my senses, Everything was chaos. Up and down. Physically, I was feeling okay, but mentally, I was a basket case. Her talk braced me. Ryan and Christina had taken off. Timmy had just left us, and Toaf was due to arrive tonight. But for the moment, I'd be running with near strangers. They joined me for the second stretch of the day, a 19-mile night run over Saddleback Mountain. It got me thinking about how my team had worked, and occasionally not worked, so far. It got me wondering about how teams come together or fall apart. It made me nervous as we ran through the night that my current team consisted of me and two men I'd never met before. And we were plunging into the most challenging last step before the final ascent. This was the darkness before the dawn. John Rodrigue and Chris Tarzan Clemens looked stable enough, and I'd heard they had toughness. But I was at the end of my rope, and I didn't have anything left to manage a team. I needed to be managed. To give that responsibility to strangers was a risk I hated to take. Could they motivate me? Were they going to know when to push me and when to give me slack? Were they going to know how to push me? A few hours before, in the afternoon of day 42, I'd been ready to walk it in to Katahdin. It was a critical moment. I was also a little worried Tarzan might think I was deranged. He'd seen me beat my broken pole into pieces earlier in the day. Not a good first impression. John had come to us via the friendly and uber-helpful Maine Trail Monsters Running Club, so I knew he'd at least have experience out here in the endless North Country. Tarzan was here with Luis, and I trusted El Coyote's choices. It was comforting to run with them, knowing that Tarzan had thru-hiked the AT in 2012, so he had recent memories of what I was going through. Beyond those few details, I didn't know them. The FKT was at its most perilous. We were officially in make-or-break mode, and I'd be running with the equivalent of Facebook friends of friends. But beggars couldn't be choosers. The last goal of the day was to get in 19 miles and spend the night at the Spalding Mountain lean-to. The miles would include a 2,000-foot trek up Saddleback Mountain, then a drop back down, followed by another 2,000-foot climb up Spalding Mountain, and everywhere in between, the countless mini-climbs the AT is known for. After we'd climbed 6 miles through the dense forest, we popped out onto an open alpine ridge. As we neared the top, the fog was so thick I could feel its tendrils swirling around my face. It blotted out the sky, and as we ran, our packs and clothes were dotted by drops of rain that seemed to materialize out of nowhere. With John motivating us, we made a steady push up and down the ridges of Saddleback. Nothing spectacular, but our rhythm reassured me that I could still perform when I had to. I took the opportunity to interview them both, and hoped not to find out anything discomforting. John was an unassuming hard man, a single dad with a grown son who'd recently caught the ultra-running bug himself. He was a self-reliant and reserved. A classic Maine provincialist who heard I would be running through the local trails and cleared his schedule to be available to help in any way. Chris Clemens was paper thin, but quick as a whippet, with muscles like steel cords. Caballo Blanco had called him Tarzan because he had long brown hair and was perfectly comfortable in the middle of nowhere. Chris filled his pack with an outdoorsman's knack, jamming in a tent, sleeping bags, and more food than I could imagine us eating. It turned out to be just the right amount, but I could never consume enough calories per day. I'd still lost close to 19 pounds. I quickly dismissed my apprehension about whether these guys would help me perform. Having their fresh energy around me was as good as being with old friends. It was still light when we summited Saddleback, a beautiful mountain with slopes covered in purple and pink midsummer wildflowers. We picked up the pace as the trail dropped suddenly into a steep decline, and there, to my shock, was Timmy, with a can of Pabst Blue Ribbon in each hand. He had decided he wasn't ready to leave the adventure just yet. Clearly in a party mood, He'd been up at the crest with a couple of guys who worked at the Saddleback Ski Lodge. They'd hiked up the ski run, and the three of them had started the party without us. "Man," Timmy said boisterously, "when you guys were coming down the ridge, it looked like you were descending on a cloud." He was beaming at me, and I later found out why. He said that as I was running down the hill, he could tell from the look on my face that I was back in the game. He said it was the polar opposite of the look he'd seen less than 12 hours earlier, when I told him it was all over. Timmy's mood, as usual, was contagious, and the party at the top of the mountain felt celebratory, a harbinger of good fortune. That night at the Spalding Mountain lean-to was wet and dreary, but on the morning of day 43, I dragged myself out of my sleeping bag at 4:30, squeezed as much water out of my socks as possible, and got ready by consuming the leftover pizza J.Lew had packed for me and a couple of Cliff Bars. They broke down my tent, and I went ahead without them, knowing they would catch up. I had 4.5 days to reach Katahdin. I'd slept a mere 4 hours for the second consecutive night. Each night was the same. As soon as I laid my head down, it felt like it was time to wake up. I needed to get more sleep, but I also needed to cover more miles. Despite the mist and fog, the air was balmy even before sunrise. I'd woken up warm, so I felt loose and just a touch rested. But the real reason I was feeling good was I knew Toph, Kim, and Chrissy were about to join our team. But as excited as I was for the arrival of one of my oldest and most trusted friends, I had no idea just how crucial he would be in the last excruciating days and hours of the FKT. The morning of day 43 quickly warmed up as the storm passed. Just as we left the talus slope and re-entered the green tunnel, I spotted an oncoming runner, Topher. "Are you kidding me? This trail is crazy. It's so gnarly. Is it all like this?" "You're in for a real treat," I said as I gave him a solid hug. True to form, he wasted no time. "From right now, we've got 4 days and 5 hours to get to the top of Katahdin. You'll need to average somewhere close to 50 miles a day. It should be doable if we execute it right. The X factor is sleep. The Y factor is your hourly pace." Topher had the numbers. He had the authority. He had my ear. If he said it was possible, I believed him. I didn't have the energy to doubt. Less than an hour later, as I was coming down a massive hill, the trees began to thin, the grade gradually leveled, and I could finally see the road that the trail crossed. As we got closer, I spotted Castle Black and several cars. More important, I saw the people who would determine my immediate fate. J.Lew was there with Chrissy, a longtime ultra-runner friend of ours. And there was Topher's wife, Kim, herself an ultra-runner and a crew chief extraordinaire. Walter was scheduled to rejoin us tomorrow, as was my Boulder friend, Aaron Ralston, who would both run the 100-mile wilderness with me. Ralsty famously amputated his own arm with a cheap multi-tool to escape death in a Utah slot canyon, so I hoped that his grit and determination would rub off on us all. There would also be a new guy from the Maine Trail Monsters Club, Joe Robleski. He held the self-supported FKT for the 100-mile wilderness AT section. Most skilled hikers spend about 9 to 12 days traversing the 100-mile wilderness, but Iron Joe had run it in 43 hours. I needed to do it in under 48. Anything more and I could kiss the record goodbye. In the past, the best moments in my life were when I reached down and found inner strength where I thought none existed. But I needed more than my own strength these days. I needed the strength embodied by the people standing by the side of the road, waving and calling out. This time, I really didn't have any strength left, but my team did. And even if they gave it to me, it still wouldn't be mine. It would be ours, collectively, just like the FKT would be, if we managed to get it. Later, after Katahdin, I would look back and realize this moment was when the long, final day began. A day that would combine many terrestrial days into one barely differentiated stretch of running and resting, split up only nominally by a few stolen hours of sleep. Night and day no longer meant anything other than whether or not we needed our headlamps. I was disoriented, like in the floating state of consciousness during an extended hospital stay. Sleep deprivation makes time peel back at the edges. You can start to lose your bearings very quickly. You wake up at strange hours, and never when you mean to. You doze off in the middle of conversations or during meals. Your sleep isn't quite sleep. Your waking isn't exactly waking. It starts to feel like you're living your life in a permanent twilight, where your circadian rhythms have lost their beat, and you might collapse at any moment. Topher set the pace, which in typical Topher fashion, was precisely calculated. I was more tired than ever, but I could also feel the strength emanating from Topher and Chrissy. Two people who shared a very special gift for endurance and meeting almost impossible challenges. There was immense trust among the three of us. We knew we could function effectively as a single unit. The sport of ultra running cultivates perseverance in the face of pain, fatigue, illness, and anything else. For that reason, to the untrained eye, it might seem to reward the self-sufficient and punish any kind of weakness. But the most experienced and highest-achieving ultra runners learn that without support, it's easy to wander aimlessly. And without a crew that you can honestly turn to for help, a crew that truly understands you, you won't be able to help yourself. Even the most eccentric among us, and yes, I'm referring here to the speed goat, depend on other people far more than an outsider might suppose. Of course, there's something else you'll always need, something that other people can never give you. Sleep. Around 10 p.m. on day 43, we were running along the narrow edge of a cliff above a river. The sound of the running water lulled me towards sleep, and I felt myself drifting in and out of full consciousness. In a desperate voice, I told Toph that I was falling asleep while walking, and I was worried I might sleepwalk to my death. He looked back at me and studied my face. Topher not only ran, he also ran businesses. I knew he was experienced in judging this type of situation, the situation being whether or not to believe me, and then whether or not to give me what I wanted. Tough love meant pushing me on in spite of my protests. I had wanted Topher to come out here to support me, not to pamper me or serve as my butler. I got what I wanted. "As soon as I find a spot," he said. And so we continued, and I continued to stagger on half asleep. There was no room to pitch even our tiny tent, so we went another mile or two until we finally found a place where the trail opened wider than shoulder width. Topher and Chrissy got the tent up almost instantly, directly on the trail, and I lay back and was suddenly asleep. They set an alarm to go off in 2 hours, at 4:45 a.m., and hunkered down shoulder to shoulder in makeshift bivy sacks made from their down jackets and a bug net. They later told me they fell asleep making jokes about the definition of friendship, as in, "This must be it." Or why the hell else would they be lying on the trail under one sleeping bag for me? The long last day continued 2 hours later. In the dark gray pre-dawn light, Chrissy and Topher woke me up and sent me down the trail by myself for a few minutes while they took down the tent and gathered our stuff. As I shuffled off, I remembered something that the speed goat had told me about getting to the 100-mile wilderness.
"You don't have to rally at that point," he'd said. "You just need to keep walking on the AT treadmill, 3.5 miles per hour."
So I kept walking, picked up the pace, and settled into the hurried quick step that carried me north for so many miles. On the morning of day 44, we reached the banks of the Kennebec River, a clear, fast-moving, and deceptively friendly-looking body of water. Compared with the countless narrow rivers and streams I'd crossed thus far, the Kennebec seemed like a lake. It looked shallow enough to ford